Tonight, we welcome those fabulous Philadelphians. Founded in 1900, its sound shaped by those giants Leopold Stokowski and Eugene Ormandy, the Philadelphia Orchestra is one of America's greatest symphonies. This evening at the Royal Albert Hall, it performs a work it premiered in 1941, Rachmaninoff's Symphonic Dances, along with Ravel's La Valse and Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto, played by Janine Jansen. Well, the orchestra got out of America just in time to avoid the chaos and airport closures brought about by Hurricane Irene. It also left storms of its own making back in Pennsylvania. The orchestra board's decision earlier this year to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Smaller American orchestras are going out of business at a startling rate, but the venerable Philadelphians, their demise seems almost inconceivable. That's all back, though, on the other side of the Atlantic. Tonight, here in a packed Royal Albert Hall, as Maestro Charles Dutoit makes his way onto the platform, the open with Sibelius's great anthem in praise of his homeland, Finlandia, the Philadelphia Orchestra at the BBC Proms.
Thank you.
Sibelius's Finlandia, the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Charles Dutoit, who's just about to enter his final season as chief conductor of this great ensemble. Well, we've already heard Tchaikovsky's violin concerto once this season, albeit rearranged for piano and played by Dejan Lazic. Tonight, the work in its original form with soloist Janine Janssen. The concerto is the product of a holiday at Clarens on Lake Geneva, a little loss for inspiration. Things brightened up when Tchaikovsky was joined by a guest, the young violinist Josef Kotek, who had been one of his former theory students at the Moscow Conservatoire. The two men spent hours playing music together, and soon Tchaikovsky started his concerto, sketched out in 11 days flat. Well, written at speed, it may have been, but it shows Tchaikovsky's supreme mastery as a musician. Janine Janssen.
I love playing that piece. I have not played it now for a few years, actually, because I made a recording a few years ago, which was great fun to do with Mahler Chamber and Daniel Harding. So I really got into the piece then so much. And now coming back to it, it is just such a joy. It has everything in it, you know, the virtuosity, but also the incredible lyricism and also quite, I don't know, nostalgic. There's some, yeah, of course, also quite intimate sadness to it, I would say, in the second movement. But then, of course, the third movement completely, takes you through, all the folk tunes. I think it's I love playing it. It's a challenging piece. It's a lot of technical challenges, but it's so well written. It's just really fun to play.
Janine Janssen. Well, Tchaikovsky had begun to have concerns that the muse was leaving him before he started work on this piece. Am I played out, he wrote. I have to squeeze out of myself weak and worthless ideas and ponder every bar. Then along came Josef Kotek, a student of the great violinist Josef Joachim in Berlin. Much speculation about the degree of intimacy that existed between the two men, and perhaps for that reason, wanting to avoid gossip, Tchaikovsky dedicated the piece to Leopold Auer. That turned out to be not a great decision, because Auer never actually played it. It had to wait 4 years before it got its premiere in Vienna in 1881 in the hands of Adolf Grotzky. Well, tonight it's played by Janine Janssen. Here she comes, making her way center stage, Charles Dutoit behind her, to join the Philadelphia Orchestra in Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto.
Thank you. Thank you.
Janine Jansen playing Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto here at the Proms with the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Charles Dutoit. An absolutely capacity audience tonight here at the Royal Albert Hall. I gather hundreds of people were turned away from the arena queue. This really is one of the big spectaculars of the last week of the 2011 Proms season. Philadelphia Orchestra approaching the end of a fortnight-long tour. Janine Jansen playing with them in several concerts. She returns to the stage now. Not as many as originally planned. She's been suffering from the flu, which meant that she missed concerts in Dublin and Edinburgh, but now back to health. Played with them in Essen last night and again here at the Royal Albert Hall this evening. She bows to the audience, acknowledges David Kim, concertmaster of the Philadelphia Orchestra, former member of the BBC Radio 3 New Generation Artist Scheme. We're going to be seeing and hearing lots of her here in London over the next year. She has an upcoming residence at the Wigmore Hall and also a residence with the London Philharmonic Orchestra. In fact, she'll be doing this tour in reverse, as it were, because she'll be touring the US with the LPO. She returns to the platform now with Charles Dutoit. She's wearing a black dress tonight with a splendid orange underneath, perhaps to represent her nationality as a Dutch musician. There's her own annual chamber music festival in Utrecht in the Netherlands. Shakes hands with Charles Dutoit. Dutoit coming to the end of 4 years as artistic advisor and chief conductor of the Philadelphia Orchestra. Next year, Yannick Nézet-Séguin will become the orchestra's eighth music director. Well, as I say, Tchaikovsky wrote his concerto for Josef Kotek, a young student who'd come to study theory with him in Switzerland. Dedicated the piece to Leopold Auer, but Auer refused to play it. Said he never wanted to master the difficulties of this concerto. Cast my poor child into the abyss, as Tchaikovsky put it. And Janine Jansen back on stage now. An encore. The Sarabande from Bach's D minor Partita, played as an encore by Janine Jansen. Bach is ever a popular choice for encore material from violinists, selected as well by Anza Pimutta with the Pittsburgh Orchestra on Tuesday night. Two orchestras from one American state, Pennsylvania, in this final week of the 2011 BBC Proms. Janine Jansen returns to the platform, sharing this tour with the pianist Jean-Yves Thibaudet. He'll play the Ravel concerto in the orchestra's last European concert tomorrow night in Paris. They've also been delighting critics in Grafenegg, just outside Vienna, Lucerne, Dublin, Edinburgh, and five concerts across Germany. Janine Jansen turns now to applaud the orchestra and makes her way off the Royal Albert Hall stage. Well, the razzmatazz of a great American orchestra at the Proms tonight. In 20 minutes' time, the Philadelphia Orchestra perform a work that they gave the premiere of, the very beginning of 1941, Rachmaninoff's final work, The Symphonic Dances, and we evoke the collapse of decadent Imperial Vienna in Ravel's La Valse. First, it's time to join Anne McElvoy for tonight's Proms Plus literary event, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, across the road from us, here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Welcome to this Proms Plus literary event. This year's Proms season has seen some of the world's greatest pianists gracing the stage at the Royal Albert Hall, from Stephen Hoff to Angela Hewitt, with Lang Lang still to come on the last night on Saturday. The piano is an instrument most widely celebrated in other art forms, not least because of the romantic fascination it's exercised. Jane Campion's film The Piano won 3 Oscars and boasted a best-selling soundtrack. Though as the mother of struggling musical offspring, I rather like the creepy French thriller in which a pianist wreaks decades of revenge on an examiner who interrupted her recital. But what do literary incarnations of the piano and pianists tell us about the instrument and our relationship with it? To help us trace the piano's appearance in the pages of some of our best-loved books is the writer and life peer Baroness Julia Neuberger. Julia was one of Britain's first female rabbis. She's written on everything from the story of Judaism to the NHS, and I like to think she has some piano music on while she's doing so. Alongside Julia's literary tour of the piano, we're also joined by the actress Barbara Flynn, who's appeared in dramas from Cranford to Channel 4's The Queen. She'll be bringing Julia's chosen literary extracts to life for us. And this journey wouldn't be complete without a starring role for the instrument itself. The pianist, Liz Burley, will be offering musical reminders of why the piano has so gripped some of the great literary talents. Please welcome them all. Now, Julia, the piano, as we know, is a relatively modern invention, and the instruments originally played by the likes of Mozart and Bach would have sounded very different from the instrument Liz is seated at here today. Your first example of the piano taking a starring role picks up on this idea of it being new and modern.
And very expensive, and something that everybody who's grand or has any pretensions ought to have. It's from Jane Austen's Emma, and it dates to 1815.
Well, let's hear Barbara Flynn reading us an extract from Emma.
Mrs. Cole was telling that she had been calling on Miss Bates, and as soon as she entered the room, had been struck by the sight of a pianoforte. A very elegant-looking instrument. Jane herself was at a loss, quite bewildered to think who could possibly have ordered it. But now they were both perfectly satisfied that it could be only from one quarter. Of course, it must be from Colonel Campbell. I declare, I do not know when I have heard anything that has given me more satisfaction. It always has quite hurt me that Jane Fairfax, who plays so delightfully, should not have an instrument. It seemed quite a shame, especially considering how many houses there are where fine instruments are absolutely thrown away. This is like giving ourselves a slap, to be sure. And it was but yesterday I was telling Mr. Cole, I really was ashamed to look at our new grand pianoforte in the drawing room. While I do not know one note from another, and our little girls, who are just beginning, perhaps may never make anything of it. And there is poor Jane Fairfax, who is mistress of music, has not anything of the nature of an instrument, not even the pitifulest old spinet in the world to amuse herself with.
Thank you very much. Now, there's an expectation that we hear there, Julia, that any competent, well-brought-up 19th century girl would be able to play. But real talent is something rare.
Real talent is something very rare, and indeed what's clear is that Jane Fairfax has real talent and that they do all really recognise that. I mean, they do make a point. She's the one with the talent, she's the one that doesn't have an instrument. And I also love the fact that they're so rude about the old instruments, not even the pitifulest old spinet. You know, if you were anybody and you had any pretensions, there you were with a piano. It would have been a very different sounding piano from the one that we have now, but it would have been a piano, and yes, you had to learn, and I think a lot of girls were put through piano lessons that they might well not have enjoyed because, you know, that's what you had to show you could do.
That's a perfect point for Liz to give us an idea of the piano's role in the starring role that it had in Proceedings. She's going to play us an extract from one of Mendelssohn's Songs Without Words, where the piano does the singing all by itself. Thank you, Liz. Now, Julia, we're going to move to full-on piano romantics next. Let's turn to George Eliot's Daniel Deronda. Eliot's drawing on a real-life composer in this novel.
Indeed she is. Most people seem to think that Herr Klezmer is based on the composer Liszt, and indeed that what's going on is very much a romance in the way that he plays, and indeed his own composition, and a young woman who is listening to him with rapt adoration.
"Here comes Herr Klezmer," said Mrs. Arrowpoint, rising and presently bringing him to Gwendolyn. She left them to a dialogue which was agreeable on both sides. Everyone became anxious to hear Gwendolyn sing. Gwendolyn was not nervous. What she undertook to do, she did without trembling, and singing was an enjoyment to her. Her voice was a moderately powerful soprano. "You have not been well taught," said Herr Klezmer quietly. Woman was dear to him, but music was dearer. "Still, you are not quite without gifts. You sing in tune and you have a pretty fair organ, but you produce your notes badly, and that music which you sing is beneath you. Sing now something larger, and I shall see."
"Oh, not now. By and by," said Gwendolyn, with a sinking of heart at the sudden width of horizon opened round her small musical performance. Miss Arrowpoint helped her by saying, "Yes, by and by. I always require half an hour to get up my courage after being criticised by Herr Klezmer. We will ask him to play to us now. He is bound to show us what is good music." To be quite safe on this point, Herr Klezmer played a composition of his own, a fantasia called Freudvoll, Liedvoll, Gedankenvoll, an extensive commentary on some melodic ideas, not too grossly evident, and he certainly fetched as much variety and depth of passion out of the piano as that moderately responsible instrument lends itself to, having an imperious magic in his fingers that seemed to send a nerve thrill through ivory key and wooden hammer and compel the strings to make a quivering, lingering speech for him.
It's about sex, and it's being used as an instrument of sexual attraction. What I love, of course, is George Eliot saying, you know, woman was dear, but music was dearer still. I mean, let's get our order of priorities right. And in this particular instance, you know, she sang very prettily, but not good enough. She could have been better taught. So, but of course, he's not making a play for Gwendolyn. He's making a play for Catherine Arrowpoint at the time. So it's quite an interesting mixed message coming through, because Gwendolyn is being tried out, but the romance is going elsewhere.
Well, it's very appropriate we should illustrate this thinly veiled version of Liszt with music from the man himself. Liz, what are you going to be playing for us?
I've chosen a short extract from O Lieb by Liszt.
Thank you, Liz, and O Lieb. Now, Julie, you've indulged your romantic side, but there is also another side, or many other sides, to the piano, and you're going to choose a more discordant moment for us now, I think.
Absolutely. Miles Franklin, My Brilliant Career, tells the story of Sibylla Melvin, who grew up in rural Australia in the 1890s and who fell on hard times, or rather her father basically drank the family money away, and she eventually gets sent as a sort of housekeeper skivvy to a family where by then everybody had a piano, and they did indeed have a piano, the McSwats, but it was a pretty terrible kind of piano, and you've got a mixed message, because she uses the piano to give solace to herself because she's a sensitive young thing, and at the same time the piano is truly awful, and there's quite a lot of humour there.
Well, Barbara, do take us to Australia and read us some Miles Franklin.
Give us a tune on the piano, said Mrs. McSwat after the meal, when the dishes had been cleared away by Eliza and Rose Jane. I acceded to Mrs. McSwat's request with alacrity, thinking that while forced to remain there, I would have one comfort and would spend all my time at the piano. I opened the instrument, brushed a little of the dust from the keys with my pocket handkerchief, and struck the opening chords of Kowalski's Marche Angloise. I have heard of pianos sounding like a tin dish, but this was not as pleasant as a tin dish by Longchalks. Every note that I struck stayed down, not to rise. And when I got them up, the jarring, clanging, discordant clatter they produced beggars description. There was not the slightest possibility of distinguishing any tune on the thing. Won't it play? Inquired Mr. McSwat. No, the keys stay down. Then, Rose Jane, go you and pick them up while she tries again. I tried again, Rose Jane fishing up the keys as I went along. I perceived instantly that not one had the least ear for music or idea what it was. So I beat on the demented piano with both hands, and often with all fingers at once. And the bigger row I made, the better they liked it.
Thank you, Barbara, fresh from her new gig with the Australian Broadcast Company. Julia, the solace of music is there, and it's in a comic form. This young woman who is living with a roughish family, they're a very decent one in many ways, but no feeling for music, and these two worlds are very hard to bridge for her.
She finds it extraordinarily hard, and in fact, eventually she has a sort of nervous collapse and gets sent back home. And they were a very decent family in some ways, but they just didn't get it. And the idea that, you know, you send your daughter to pick up the keys as they get stuck down is just sort of, you know, the idea that they actually even thought that was possible is beyond belief. But I do love it. It's a wonderful novel.
Well, it's time for your final choice now, and this features one of the most captivating pianists in literature, Madame Merle, in Henry James' Portrait of a Lady. Tell us a little bit about that choice.
Well, there's a really interesting question about Madame Merle. She's a mysterious figure. She seems to have a charisma that nobody quite understands. She's never actually introduced by the servants. She's in a kind of different class from anybody else in the novel. And she herself talks about how she defines herself by her possessions. Yet when she plays, and she plays Schubert, she captivates the world and people can't stop listening. I mean, she's not, it's possibly an embodiment of evil, or at least of less than good. And there's a whole question about what James was really trying to do in the novel. But Madame Merle is this mysterious figure who, when she sits down at the piano possibly takes her over, and she completely brings a room to silence and she changes people's emotions.
Well, let's hear Barbara Flynn reading from Portrait of a Lady in a moment, and we will hear Liz playing some Schubert, appropriately, straight afterwards.
The lady was, of course, a visitor who had arrived during her absence and who had not been mentioned by either of the servants. The advent of a guest was in itself far from disconcerting. She had not yet divested herself of a young faith that each new acquaintance would exert some momentous influence on her life. She became aware that the lady at the piano played remarkably well. She was playing something of Schubert's. Isabel knew not what, but recognized Schubert. And she touched the piano with a discretion of her own. It showed skill. It showed feeling. Isabel sat down noiselessly on the nearest chair and waited till the end of the piece. When it was finished, she felt a strong desire to thank the player and rose from her seat to do so, while at the same time the stranger turned quickly round, as if but just aware of her presence.
Thank you, Liz. She was playing Schubert's impromptu, Opus 19, number 3. And that, I'm afraid, is the final chord in this exploration of the piano's finest literary moments. Many thanks to my guests, Julia Neuberger, Barbara Flynn, and Liz Burley.
Anne McElvoy presented this evening's Proms Plus Literary event, and the producer was Georgia Mann. And this is Petroc Trelawney welcoming you back live to the Royal Albert Hall, where the Philadelphia Orchestra and Charles Dutoit give tonight's prom. In the second half, Ravel's La Valse, and to start, Rachmaninoff's Symphonic Dances, written for this orchestra in the summer of 1940. The previous winter, the Philadelphia Orchestra had played five all-Rachmaninoff concerts in New York to mark the 30th anniversary of the composer's U.S. debut. Forced into exile from war-torn Europe, Rachmaninoff was grateful for the warmth of American audiences, and living in a rented house on Long Island began what was to be his final work. Charles Dutoit is intrigued by the marking on the first dance.
One thing which has always been a question fascinating me is the tempo notation of the first dance, which is non allegro. And it's a very strange way to say something, non allegro. Is allegro in that sense means the tempo, which is the speed, or is it the allegro, the mood, you know? And I've always been thinking about that. I think it's a combination of two, so it should not be played too fast. And in that typical sort of Russian mood, which is expressed the best in the saxophone solo with the beautiful melody which comes in the middle of this first movement. And I think it makes sense. But the second movement is a waltz. It's a very sort of dark waltz, very lugubre, we say in French. And so the reason why I played this couple with Ravel La Valse is because I think La Valse is not so much a showpiece than also a sort of waltz, and it, somehow it goes very well. It starts in the sheer darkness, you know, and comes to light, and then some of it is elegant, some of it is tortured, and the end is very chaotic. You know, it's obviously probably expressed what Ravel went through during First World War, when he was a soldier himself. I mean, he was sort of conducting a truck, you see. And he wanted to name this piece Vienna, Wien, but then changed after, the fall of the Habsburg. He changed, and it's sort of like Strauss wrote The Metamorphose at the end of his life, thinking that something is cracking and something is finished, you know. So I always coupled these two pieces together for that reason.
Charles Dutoit speaking to me before this afternoon's rehearsal, and here he comes back onto the platform to conduct the Philadelphia Orchestra in Rachmaninoff's Symphonic Dances.
Thank you. Thank you.
Rachmaninoff's Symphonic Dances, played by the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Charles Dutoit. A work that the orchestra premiered on January the 3rd, 1941, under Eugene Ormandy. Rachmaninoff carried on as a concert pianist for the remaining 2 years of his life, but save from revising the fourth piano concerto, his days as a composer were then over. The Symphonic Dances, his last work. Charles Dutoit returns to the platform. Quote in the first movement from Rachmaninoff's first symphony, which had had its disastrous premiere 43 years before he wrote the dances, still obviously a bitter memory. In 1940, the score of the first symphony had been lost. It wasn't to be reconstructed and reassessed until several years after the composer's death. Clearly, even at this late stage of his life, there were still raw wounds. Philadelphia Orchestra players on their feet now here at the Royal Albert Hall. Well, Ravel's La Valse is the final piece on the programme tonight. First, a few thoughts from Charles Dutoit on the Philadelphia sound, the unique sound of the orchestra that he first conducted in 1980.
Everybody talks about the sound of the Philadelphia Orchestra, but you know, you have to produce it. It doesn't come just like this, you see. I think it's something really special, that sound, especially in the strings, that darkness and richness, that wealth of the basses, and so on, you know, it's very powerful, but also incredibly soft when required. And it has this color, which is a little bit like, I would say, butter, or like whipped cream, or like cognac. Cognac is probably a good brandy, you know, it's probably the best description of that sound, you see.
Yes, VSOP brandy, he added. The absolute opposite of Beaujolais Nouveau. Charles Dutoit returning them for the final time to the platform as we imagine a grand ball, the Imperial Austrian Court in 1855, but seen through shattered glass. Burnish the opaque mirrors. Ravel's La Valse. Thank you. As Ravel himself put it, clouds whirl about. Occasionally they part to allow a glimpse of waltzing couples. As they gradually evaporate, one can discern a gigantic hall filled by a crowd of dancers in motion. The glow of the chandeliers breaks out fortissimo, an imperial court about 1855. Ravel's La Valse, Charles Dutoit conducting the Philadelphia Orchestra here at the BBC Proms. Dutoit returns to the platform and standing right in the middle of his ensemble brings them to their feet. As they approach the end of what's been a frantically busy European tour, from Austria to Ireland, Scotland, Germany, now London and Paris tomorrow. There have been pints of Guinness in Dublin on their first ever Irish visit. Post-it notes left on aircraft seats as the orchestra swapped charter planes with the Chicago Symphony at Zurich Airport. A sweltering few days in the Vienna heat, so hot that tails were left packed in suitcases and concerts took place in shirt sleeves. From the city of the Liberty Bell to the Royal Albert Hall, the Philadelphia Orchestra. And as Charles Dutoit returns to the stage, he's clutching this time an enormous bouquet of flowers. He's making his way through the second violins to present them to Louis Lanza, who for 47 years, nearly half a century, has played violin in this orchestra. With the end of this European tour, he finally retires after a lifetime playing in one of the greatest of all American orchestras. What memories and stories Louis Lanza must have. Dutoit on the rostrum. Turning to the orchestra, encore.
Ladies and gentlemen, Lou Lanza here, this musician, is today leading the orchestra after 50 years. Loves Berlioz. Thanks to your great conductor Colin Davis, who did so much to help the fame of Berlioz. He did so many good things here. And in his honor, we will play the Hungarian March from the Damnation of Faust. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra, the first American orchestra to visit Britain after the war. That was in 1949. How fantastic to have them back again here at the Proms in 2011. Conducted by Charles Dutoit. That encore, the Hungarian March from Berlioz's Damnation of Faust, bringing this prom to its conclusion. Orchestra heading home now after a concert tomorrow night in Paris. Back to uncertain times in Philadelphia with that decision to enter Chapter 11 bankruptcy. David Kim, the leader, acknowledging a certain amount of trepidation and sadness among orchestra members, but the orchestra's president, Alison Vargamore, suggesting from back home in Philadelphia, things are happening that may point to a brighter future. The orchestra's new season starting at the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts on Friday, October the 14th. Dutoit conducting Beethoven 7 as he begins his final season as the orchestra's chief conductor. Well, tomorrow night here at the BBC Proms, the penultimate prom of the season, Weber's Der Freischütz, conducted by John Elliott Gardner. That's at 7:30 tomorrow night, live here on BBC Radio 3. But with those fabulous Philadelphians on their feet on the Royal Albert Hall stage, performing this evening under Maestro Charles Dutoit. For now, as he returns to the stage one more time, it's time to bid you good night from the Royal Albert Hall and return you to Jonathan Swain at Broadcasting House.
Petrock, thank you. Petrock Trelawney there at the Royal Albert Hall. Well, in 8 minutes or so tonight, the last in a series of three special Music Matters in which Tom Service gets unprecedented access to three of Britain's most important composers. Tonight, Tom travels to one of the northernmost of the Orkney Isles to meet the master of Queen's music, Sir Peter Maxwell Davis, whose new work receives its world premiere at the last night of the Proms this coming Saturday evening. That's Music Matters at 10 o'clock this evening. Until then, a little more French music. One of Poulenc's first published pieces, the Sonata for Piano Duet. Four hands at the one piano here. Poulenc was 19 when he wrote it in the last months of the Great War, while doing a statutory period of military service. And he was a fine pianist himself in his teens. He'd studied with that Spanish champion of the moderns, Ricardo Vignes. So the sonata's quite a challenge to play. The pianists are Pascal Roger and Jean-Philippe Collard. Thank you. the 19-year-old Francis Poulenc's Sonata for Piano Duet. The duetting pianists there were Pascal Roger and Jean-Philippe Collard. Sunday here on BBC Radio 3 brings Shakespeare.
A lion among ladies is a most dreadful thing.
Sunday Night Shakespeare in Drama on 3 with Roger Allam, Leslie Sharp and Toby Stevens.
I know a bank where the wild thyme blows, where ox lips and the nodding violet grows, quite uncanopied with luscious woodbine, with sweet musk roses and with eglantine.
A special performance of A Midsummer Night's Dream, recorded deep in the heart of a wood one midsummer night.
What angel wakes me from my flowery bed?
Quarrelling fairies stand nature on its head, play havoc with young love, and mix mortals with magic.
My Oberon.
A unique performance of A Midsummer Night's Dream. Drama on 3, Sunday night at 8 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's 10 o'clock and time now for the last in a series of special Music Matters programmes, where Tom Service meets some of Britain's most important composers. This evening, in a programme first broadcast in 2009, Tom meets Sir Peter Maxwell Davies.
Orkney is a place of magic, where a hump on the ground is probably a millennia-old burial mound, and where a weathered old stone in the earth could be an ancient druidic altarpiece. And it's also, right now, a place where sea is melting into sky, where land is shimmering into air, and light is just flickering into dark. This continually changing weatherscape is around me today. But it's also a place where, on one of Orkney's most northerly isles, Sandaig, you can find at work the master of the Queen's music, Sir Peter Maxwell Davies.
I guess I turn in now, do I? Oh, he's going to let us in too. Oh, here we go. What a beautiful place. It's completely manicured. It's absolutely amazing. So just out of fields of Swede and a kind of brown water looking loch is this fantastic, colourful house. Original stone, blue windows and doors, and there's Max in the window.
Right.
Turn round, park next to there. Oh, they've got an Audi. Here we go. I guess that's okay. A boat. I don't know if they get out in that much. Oh, there's Judy. Here's the dog, Judy Keltoft. Maxwell Davies, or Max, as he's known to everyone, has lived on Orkney for the past 3.5 decades. For a quarter of a century, he was in a house perched on top of one of Hoy's mountainous sea cliffs. But for the last 10 years or so, he's been on the flatter, more hospitable climes of Sandaig. And yet Sandaig is really just as extreme as the twists and turns of Max's music. Long stretches of white beaches that are playgrounds for the continual swell and crash of the seas up here. It's an 8-mile spit of spidery land that holds its head just above the water.
Do you get fish in the loch, Max? Is that...
Not many.
Not many, no. I mean, is it a trout loch, though, or is it...
Yes, effect,
yeah.
Yes, but... The North Loch at the top end of the island is much, much better.
Yeah. But it's possibly pretty brackish because that's the sea right there. This is a kind of liminal place, isn't it? It's in between sea and sky and water and
it's on the edge of everything.
Max was born in Salford, Manchester, in 1934. And when he was at music college in Manchester, he was really an enfant terrible, along with his fellow musical provocateurs, Harrison Birtwistle, Alexander Gurr, Elgar Howarth, and John Ogden. And he set up the Fires of London, the first new music group of its kind in the country, and achieved a reputation already in his 30s as one of the most iconoclastic composers around. Pieces like World's Bliss, booed at the proms in 1969, and Eight Songs for a Mad King. Meanwhile, on Orkney, he wrote pieces for children and the community here from the mid-70s onwards, and he also embarked on epic cycles of symphonies, concertos and string quartets. Max celebrated his 75th birthday at the start of last month, and he's just as prolific as ever in the house he shares with his partner, Colin Parkinson, and his dog, Judy. Max showed me round this ancient farmhouse that he's converted into the crucible of his creativity.
Out there is North Ronaldsay, which today you can't see.
That's the northernmost of the Orkney.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And there are these great waves coming here. There are great gulfs and under the water there, these banks, and you get these wonderful wave formations come in. And you do get that line of white horses, which is very dramatic.
It's thrilling. Look, there are runes here, yes, outside Max's studio here. What does this say?
Colin built this, and that it's my studio.
But in runic, right?
Yes.
Or in, yeah.
Yes.
Beautiful.
Mind your head.
You know, it's a bit like being inside a boat itself, actually.
Yes.
I don't know, it's about, 10 metres long or something, a study, lined on one side with books and scores, a baby grand piano in the middle, Max. And then, you see, now everything on the walls here, that's Monteverdi, right?
Well, we don't know. It could well be.
It's a very handsome portrait of what, you must feel that it is Monteverdi. You want it to be, surely.
I'd love it to be. And the ears and the eyes and the moustache are exactly like the portrait of him in his old age, but there he is very young, if it is him.
But everything on the wall here tells a story about you, it seems to me. There's a collage of an American flag.
Yes, that was one of the sketches for the Third Naxos Quartet. When Iraq was invaded, I was so absolutely bloody furious and disappointed that no lessons had been learned from history, from Vietnam or from the Crusades or anything, and the same mistakes were being made with Afghanistan and Iraq. That was a sketch for the Third Naxos Quartet, just as the picture next to it, which Colin and I fashioned together, is a sketch for the Second Quartet. It's a landscape.
So both of these, when you say they're sketches, what we're talking about are collages made from found objects. So the one that you describe as a sketch for the Third Quartet is a frame of driftwood, and inside it looks like, I don't know, it looks like a piece of fabric made into an American flag, sort of spattered with bits of, it looks like rust coloration, blood or something.
Blood, yes.
Literally blood. And there's what is there, barbed wire going around,
yes,
as framing,
yes,
this. And this is something you made, Max.
Yes, I mean, yes, and just feeling the textures and the design of it. It has to do with the design of that bit of the Third Naxos Quartet.
Which is the second movement, right? Or
yes,
the slow movement, which is
both of them, in fact, where I use the In Nomine.
Of John Taverner.
John Taverner.
Chant.
And the Plain Song from the 1500s. But it's very much, don't do this in my name.
So an anti-In Nomine,
yes,
and not in my name.
Anti-In Nomine, if you like.
How long have you been making visual things as sketches? Because, you know, you describe these as sketches, which they sort of literally are because they're visual, but they're also part of the composition of these pieces. How long have you been doing that?
Always, but it's only in the last few years I've kept any. Odd ones might have survived in diaries or whatever, but I've only bothered to keep them recently.
Well, they're beautiful. I never knew you did that.
Ah. Well, I don't think anybody knew, but they are very much working sketches towards textures and shapes.
So the sound is already something physical then, and, you know, it's not just music, right? Or it's not just sound.
It's already architecture, if you like, and blocks and contrasts.
Beside your sketch for the Third Quartet, the Jasper Johns like American flag, you have your own sketches for music you're actually writing now. A pair of glasses, something that would be much more identifiable as a sketch, because there's pencils on one side, it looks like a very beautiful single rosehip in a vase, and reams and reams of paper of what you're working on now. What is the piece then?
This is a piece I'm doing for the Orpheus Ensemble in New York. They want a companion piece for the Bach Fifth Brandenburg, and I'm doing something which I haven't really done since the 60s, which is thinking of the art of fugue and a musical offering and doing all sorts of technical things which I have just not done
since
that period.
Those late Bach pieces, which are almost like
combination between arcane compositional exercise in a way and, you know, spiritual investigation.
Yes, yes. And I think it's really incorporating it into techniques I've established concerning transformations and magic squares and whatever. So it's a great deal more mature and it feels much, much more under control. Although, of course, the exciting thing about writing a new piece of music is it's never under control, really.
What's it called?
I don't know yet. I really don't know.
I see you just behind your pencil sharpener there. You have the Traité de l'Orchestration, the Treaty of Orchestration. Who is that by?
It's Charles Koechlin. That book is a great, great help, and I keep it there. I have the Liber Usualis on this side, the classic book of plain song, and a real book of plain song.
Oh, wow. Well, how old is that, then?
That's 14th century.
A 14th century book of plain song.
Yeah.
See, there's a very interesting collection of things here, because you have those books and you have the ancientnesses, if you like, of those traditions, which are still living in so much of your music. And then you look out over a small... It's like a porthole into the courtyard, which would be when you're sitting down on a very austere wooden bench without a back. You would look out into the thing, and you've got three fossils of ammonites. And you've also got, above that, you've got a Christ on the cross in wood. And there's also a much older-looking... it looks like it comes from the altarpiece of the Holy Grail. See, this suggests an awful lot of things about relationships with tradition, different kinds of musical tradition, different kinds of time, fossils and newness, and also with religion as well. But you're not, you know, quote-unquote, a religious person.
Not at all. No, no, no.
But there's an awful lot of religious iconography in Israel.
Yes, I find religion absolutely fascinating.
There's a Madonna there above your...
Yes, a very beautiful one. I find this whole concept of God and religion quite fascinating, and clearly God doesn't have an independent existence from us. It's something which is a projection of the worst and the best in us, a collective projection, if you like. Communities project their own gods. And it does help people to get through their lives tremendously, and it has inspired wonderful works of art. And I have no problem with people who have faith. I see the Mass, for instance, as the most wonderful poem. And I have set the Mass with tremendous pleasure. I have no problem with those things. But as I get older, I become more and more atheistic. I think this concept of God is so strange and so obvious. We're animals, very intelligent animals, okay, in some respects. But we are animals, and we're just not equipped to cope with and understand these greater mysteries. I think of the fish over there in the fish tank, and drop in some food and they get very excited, and if I don't, perhaps they would start worshipping this blob that comes in the sky and praising it in the hope that food would come. I don't know, but I see religion perhaps as a little bit like that.
Okay, but why have a pre-Reformation host as the thing, probably the single most dominant...
Just over my desk.
Yeah.
Yes. A thing like that, it does have a certain power because it has helped people get through their lives. And my attitude to plain song is just the same. It is something which I really love as music. The poetry is very often wonderful. And it has helped composers. And it's gone through many composers' imaginations. And I do enjoy that tremendously.
There's another room here. Conservatory now on the west side of your study, Max, which is about, the ceiling is about 6 feet high, so I'm having to crouch down here, but it's completely open. It's like you're actually in the landscape.
Yes, you know? It's a lovely place to come and just enjoy looking at the sunset, and in winter when you're fortunate enough to have the Northern Lights, it's a marvellous place to watch that.
I've seen pictures of this. Uh-huh. This is your gigantic papier-mâché gramophone horn. That was your sole means of playing music on hoy, right?
Yes, it was. And
I've still got all my old records.
The 78s?
The 78 RPM records, yes. You must listen to it.
What have we got then?
I don't know yet. Let's have a look. I'll find a foxtrot.
Okay. Wasn't it listening to foxtrots during the war, during the bombing raids in Salford, that inspired St Thomas Wake and other things? I mean, that was a powerful memory for you.
Yes, I was put into what was considered the pantry, the safest place in the house, when the bombs were falling. And I had a very small portable gramophone in there. And there was a great pile of foxtrot and Charleston records of my parents, and I played these. The sound of the foxtrot and the sound of the bombs falling and of the anti-aircraft guns going off from a field quite close by, it was very much a part of the musical experience, a feeling of some danger. And then the night we were actually bombed out, I was asleep on the couch when the bomb fell. My parents flung themselves on the top of me as everything shattered and the windows went. And next thing I remember is where the window had been, seeing the lady from the next but one house running up the street on fire, followed by two of her children on fire. And I think those things you never ever forget was all associated with that very silly music.
The things in your study, Max, that are of here,
yes.
I mean, the things you've made from the beach, which are part of the compositional process, but right on your piano is a piece called Kettletoff Pier.
Yes, that I did for Colin for his 50th birthday, and Boosie and Hawkes have just published it. I do enjoy writing these much, much lighter pieces. After I've done a big symphony, I'll probably do some more when I finish this very, very intense piece for the Orpheus Ensemble. It's a big strain, but I'll do something like that when I finish it.
As Max said, he composed this piece for his partner, Colin. They've been together on Sunday for nearly 9 years. Colin told me their story.
Yes, I tried marriage for 24 years, but it didn't work. Found a place on Hoy, pile of stones.
In the early 80s?
I moved here though in 82. We were borrowing a cottage off somebody in Stromness, and a couple of nights before, we'd seen the South Bank show. And this person, Maxwell Davies, never heard of him. And Melvin Bragg had said something that his music was elitist or something like that, and he went for him. Anyway, I was stood outside just having a fag, and this guy I've never heard of just came walking up the street, and I just went, "Nice one, give Melvin a bit of an ear roll in." And he said, "Are you up in holiday?" I said, "No, moving to Hoy, got wife, two little small kids." And he said, "Well, when you get settled, come and have a drink." So went up there and had a drink, and after about 2 years, we sort of looked at each other one day on the boat and went, "Oh dear," and realised that it took us 20 years to be together.
Even though from that moment...
We knew, yeah. and nothing ever happened. Eight odd years ago, I was living on my own and he said he was on his own, so I came up and turned up on Christmas Eve. Yeah, it'd be 9 years this Christmas Eve. I just remember being in the minibus with my last few quid I got. I managed to get a ticket up here. And he was stood in the driveway, illuminated in the headlights, with two glasses in one hand and a bottle of champagne in the other. And we just fell into each other's arms. We're just in love. It's as simple as that.
I think when I first came in 1970 to Orkney, it was a question of finding some kind of quiet, because I'd been working very, very hard. I think in 1969 I wrote St. Thomas Wake, Foxtrot for Orchestra, World's Bliss, Eight Songs of Mad King. And I came to Orkney and suddenly I thought, well, it's not a question of relaxing, it's a question of just gathering your thoughts together. And perhaps when I first went to Rackwick-on-Hoy, it was appreciating absolute quiet, a natural quiet, not an unnatural quiet. There were always sea sounds, wind sounds through heather, whatever. But this was a great experience.
It seems that from the mid-70s onwards, you know, your music in Orkney went on two different journeys at the same time. One was to go for the grandest possible scale of, say, a symphonic cycle. And at the same time, pieces that were written for this community, children's operas, pieces for individuals here. Were those things conscious on your part? You know, were you consciously having to do both, wanting to do both, or needing to?
It was a question of how can I be useful to this community? You write that which you think is the right thing for that circumstance, for the people that you're working with, and you forget everything else.
Are you being as useful when you're writing symphonies then as when you're writing children's operas and music for school children?
I doubt it very much. I don't know. I don't regret having done all those pieces, because I think a thing that a composer has to do first and foremost is bear witness. Obviously to your own life, but to what's happening around you, and somehow it's transformed into a musical statement. And I have to do that, there's no question, that's what my life is about. And I think in a world where the very survival of the planet as we know it and the very survival of humanity as we know it is up for question, if I were concerned about whether my own little efforts at reflecting and trying to be civilized or whatever in music were going to survive or not, well, I'd have my priorities wrong. There are other issues which are far, far bigger.
The other thing that brings up then is, what is the bearing witness that happens, say, in a symphony that can be related to those other parts of the world, the parts of the world that you feel passionately, strongly about, politically, socially?
It's very hard to say in words. That's why I write the music. If I were a wordsmith, I'm sure I would have spun as many words as I've spun notes, but I'm not that good with words. I know my limitations there. Perhaps I should know my limitations musically better, I don't know. But I have tried to express those things abstractly in music, but it is very hard to know quite in words what a piece is about while you're writing it. Even something which is so obvious as St. Thomas Wake, the Foxtrot for Orchestra. When I started it, I knew that it was about something out of my past, but I didn't know what. I found out as I was going on writing it. And
it ended up being about the
experience in the bomb shelter. It was exactly about the experiences, my own experiences in the war. But I was thinking again recently about my own Fifth Symphony, and I read through it again and thought, my God, whatever was going on here? This is a really emotional piece full of this extraordinary turmoil. And quite honestly, I have forgotten what it was. But there's the symphony, and it makes its own statement, and even I have forgotten the circumstances, but there it bore witness to something, and my God, it's tough.
You see, being here and looking out onto the loch there and through one window on my right and the sea just at the front of the house makes you think of the Second Symphony, which is a piece that you wrote quite consciously about different waveforms, natural phenomena that you could see from the house on Hoy. I wonder whether you think that's enough now for a piece of music to be about a natural phenomenon. You know, I mean, from the things you're saying, it's almost as if you want these things always to be about social or political things or things that are going to make a difference in the world, as if a symphony doesn't have something to say about climate change, it's not worth saying. And I wonder what, therefore, you think about a piece like that of yours, which is quite consciously about natural processes, about nature.
I'm very happy to write something which has got a political message. Not everything has, but sometimes, as when I was writing Naxos 3, that political message, suddenly it's there, it strikes you, there was this ridiculous invasion of Iraq, and I was so furious, this burst into the music. And you might say, how ridiculous that it's in a string quartet. Who the hell is going to listen to a string quartet? Certainly not the wretched Blair or Bush. But it had to be said. I had to bear witness, if you like. But a piece like that Second Symphony, an expression, if you like, of my preoccupation and trying to come to terms with the wonder that you just experience every time you go for a walk. And you want to share that with other people in a way that you can make it very clear. And for me, it's through music. And I remember writing that Second Symphony and doing quite a lot of thinking about wave shapes and the different styles of waves, where the surface moves and the content remains the same as when a piece of driftwood will just go up and down on the changing surface, will actually not move. Those things, they were very influential on the thinking of that symphony. And of course, I've used that ever since. So you do all that research into the relationship between form and content, and it stands you in good stead for writing pieces forever afterwards.
Time for a walk.
Yes,
great.
A few years ago, Max told me that he composes music in and on the landscapes of Orkney, and I wanted to experience just how he does it. So to get to one of these places where he goes on his daily composition walks, Max took us on a short drive from his house so that we could feel at first hand the wildness and wildlife of Sandy.
So do you fish the loch then? I mean, do you ever...
No. Colin fishes the sea, but not the loch.
Oh, right, OK. And was this the swans? Is this where the swan pate happened?
Yes, they've done very well this year, the swans. They've had six cygnets, and they've all survived.
Amazing. But you know when you ate? Because you ate a swan, didn't you? Right?
Yes.
Where did that happen? Was it these...
Just here, these electric wires. They come in, and those aren't the Bute swans. These are the visitors from Siberia. Hooper swans, and they sometimes hit these wires, and there's no reason why you shouldn't eat them. And you can just get off the breast and the leg meat with a Stanley knife after hanging them for a suitable period, but this whole silly thing happened because a policeman came out and saw a swan hanging up and took it into Kirkhall to the police station and commandeered the airport lounge, put it through the machine there to make sure I hadn't shot it, and the whole thing became
really
very
so
surreal.
They put it, so they wanted it, right, so put it through a metal detector to make sure that you hadn't visited any shotgun on it.
Then the police came out and cautioned Colin and me, and they had a warrant to search the freezer, and so I offered him some very nice swan to read, but he wouldn't eat it. And this got into all the papers from here through to India and Australia and Canada. And I even got on to the, what is it called? The Something or Other Richard and Judy Show?
Oh, the Richard and Judy Show,
which
must be
a television thing. Lots of people saw that.
I mean, on the right-hand side, about 10 feet away from the right-hand side of the car, is the sea. And not just any sea either. I mean, it's jade-coloured. There are white horses on it with the wind. And on the left-hand side is flat macha, so this very particular kind of marine landscape that Orkney has. And it's very flat, and there's also, looking that way, there's a flock of geese above it too. But the horizon there just seems to sort of plunge into the sea. As I turn the car right here, wow, I've got to be a bit careful here. Yeah?